It's Central Time. I'm Dean Knetter, in for Rob Ferret. You're with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up, Tim Michaels is racking up endorsements in the Wisconsin's Republican primary for governor, and the latest Marquette poll shows two candidates in the Democratic primary for U.S. Senate are neck and neck. A political scientist joins us to break down the latest Wisconsin election news. First, leaders from the Southern Baptist Convention released a third-party report this May detailing a history of sexual abuse allegations and cover-ups within the religious organization. The investigation comes after reporting 3 years ago of more than 700 cases of sexual abuse from about 400 people connected to the Southern Baptist Convention. Top leaders from the convention are said to have mishandled the cases that they knew about for as much as 20 years before the reporting came out. Former president of the SBC, Ed Litton, spoke about the report in an interview with ABC News.
Well, the rumors were always out there that these things were happening. There were several attempts made at our convention meetings to bring this to light, but they were very successfully pushed down, and this report was long overdue. Southern Baptist asked for this, demanded this.
We want to hear what you think at 800-642-1234. What has surprised you if you've been following this investigation? What do you think organizations, religious or not, should do to change in the future after something like this? Why do you think this type of story is so common for large institutions? Are you a member of the Southern Baptist Convention? If so, what do you think about this story and what should come next? Call 800-642, that's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. Marcy Hamilton is the founder and CEO of Child USA, a nonprofit think tank dedicated to preventing child abuse and neglect. She's also a professor of practice in political science at the University of Pennsylvania. Marcy, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, some of these cases we found out about went unaddressed by the Southern Baptist Convention for as many as 20 years, despite leaders knowing about them. What kind of cover-ups did we learn about in this report that kept these cases from coming out?
Well, the Southern Baptists were much like other organized religions, whether it's Catholic or Jehovah's Witnesses, in which they preferred the adults in power. And there's a great phrase in the report that says, the problem is casual indifference to child sex abuse. We see this across religions. We see this across universities. It's a nationwide problem, but it was just as rampant in the Southern Baptists as anywhere else.
The Southern Baptist Convention has at least 13 million members nationwide. A few of those, three to be exact, names from that report were tied to Wisconsin. However, here in Wisconsin, the Catholic Church is much more prominent. Obviously, a similar story in the Catholic Church. What kind of parallels were you seeing between the two organizations?
It's interesting because they're organized so differently. One's hierarchical, one's more of a flat system, but the truth is identical behaviors in that children would be sexually abused. They would try to reach out in whatever way they could, and they were either ignored or they were just treated as though they needed to get over it. And it's identical in the way that the Catholic hierarchy and the Baptist pastors have been approaching this. They've been far more interested in telling kids to forgive and forget abuse than to getting them the help they need and to bringing the abusers to justice.
I think in both instances, we've heard about religion itself, religious thinking, lessons, dogma being used as a tool for abusers, especially for young people. Can you talk a little bit more about how that can make this problem worse?
Well, you know, one of the ways that religious organizations operate, and this is in the report, is that they can treat the men as superior and the children and the women as inferior. And so the men's concerns about being incarcerated or being ashamed in public because they're abusers take precedence, and then the children are told to just please be quiet and go away. That's what happened in the Baptist Church. And at the same time, theologically, they completely torqued the meaning of confession and forgiveness, just as the Catholic Church has done in Wisconsin, in which they have said that church autonomy, the protection of church from all outside law and social obligations, means they can't be held accountable. And that's a distortion of, first of all, the Bible's text, but also that's a way of talking that keeps the powerful in place. They're not responsible to the larger public good and keeps them much more worried about their image and protecting their income than about the victims.
Have there been similar ways that the Catholic Church and the Southern Baptist Convention have used legal mechanisms to slow down investigations or avoid accountability?
Absolutely. Both denominations and many others argue vehemently that the courts cannot get documents from their records that will show the abuse. Both organizations are lobbying against access to justice for the victims and really are counting on the courts creating no open opportunities for the victims. So, you know, this is something I've said for a very long time about the Catholic bishops, and it's equally true for the SBC, is that so long as you're lobbying against your own victims in state legislatures and arguing they shouldn't get access to justice, you're going to have a problem. They can't solve their problem unless the victims have access to justice.
We're talking right now with Marcy Hamilton, founder and CEO of Child USA, a nonprofit think tank dedicated to preventing child abuse and neglect. We're talking about a recent report that found a pattern of sexual abuse and cover-up within the Southern Baptist Convention. And Marcy, you mentioned providing access to legal representation, a pathway to justice for survivors. What are some of the practical things that can change to provide that for people?
Well, the most important, and we've been working on Wisconsin for years, is a very tough state to crack on this particular issue. What's needed is that the victims from the past whose claims have already expired have the opportunity to have them revived. We've had roughly half of the states revive expired statutes of limitations for child sex abuse victims in some way. And what we've had in Wisconsin is, first, we had Archbishop Dolan, now Cardinal Dolan of New York, actively lobbying, in fact, publicly testifying against the victims in the state legislature. And now we have the Southern Baptists who are publicly stating that they will not support, in fact, they will argue against the victims having access to justice. So what that means is that victims don't have the leverage that they need in court to get the records. The big losers when you don't give victims access to justice are the public. We will never learn the full extent, the facts, the way in which our children have been endangered unless there's full accountability and full release of the information. We really just need the truth. And what many of the religious organizations and universities and others are doing right now is they're saying to lawmakers, we'll clean our own dirty laundry, we've got it. The problem is we know what happens when you let a private institution clean their own dirty laundry. They just put it away. And I don't care what the report says about the fact they're going to do better in the future, which they darn well better, or they're going to be in a lot of trouble. They're not going out of their way to make the record straight on exactly how nefarious and disastrous their policies were.
And you mentioned reviving cases that might have expired because of the statute of limitations. What does bringing something, a case back after that statute has passed, what does that involve? Does it require a change in law? Is it a case-by-case basis?
We need a change in law. And there have been bills, including this year, introduced that would enact the window that meant that we learned about 1,150 victims in California in 2003, the very first major window. New York had 11,000 victims come forward. We know about drama teachers. We know about coaches that we never would have learned about but for opening these windows. And so if parents want to know or need to know if their children are safe and where they are safe, that's what these laws do. Gives them the information and tells them the questions to ask, because they'll learn about all the mistakes that have been made in the past. But right now, it's many of our religious leaders that are standing in the way of parents getting that truth.
We're talking with Marcy Hamilton, founder and CEO of Child USA and a professor of practice in political science at the University of Pennsylvania. She's talking with us about the roughly 700 sexual assault cases and accusations that have come out in recent reporting regarding the Southern Baptist Convention. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you believe convention leaders should have done when they heard about these assaults? What do you think should happen next for organizations like this? If revelations of abuse in the Catholic Church have affected you, what does this new report from the Baptist Convention have you thinking about? What questions do you have about the legal options in cases like this? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@wpr.org. The conversation continues coming up on Central Time. Right now, we're picking up the conversation with Marcy Hamilton, founder and CEO of Child USA, a group focused on preventing child abuse. She's talking with us about a report detailing widespread sexual assault within the Southern Baptist Convention and what might come next. We're also taking your calls at 800-642-1234. What does this story have you thinking about? What questions do you have about the legal options in cases like this? 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Marcy, I want to talk a little bit more about what leaders in the SBC knew about abuse that was happening in their organization. As you mentioned, it's a little less hierarchical of a group than the Catholic Church is, but it seems like there was still a lot of knowledge, even when leaders were speaking out about abuse in the Catholic Church. Can you talk about that?
Well, first of all, we don't fully know exactly what they knew because we haven't had the kind of litigation that would tell us the full story. But for as a matter of fact, Baptists started coming forward saying they had been abused not long after the 2002 Spotlight Report in the Boston Globe. And so this story has been out there. They've been aware of it, but they've been consistently arguing that because of their organizational structure, they'll never have the same top-down problems. The issue, though, is that pastors move from church to church, and the ones that are abusing children, when they leave the one church, perhaps because of some problems and knowledge, the next church, they abuse another child. And so what they knew is they had problems. They knew they had youth ministers with problems, and they did not take them to the authorities, and they did not remove them from the faith. Instead, the victims watched them be forgiven and protected while the victims were essentially told, thanks for telling us, but that's pretty much it.
Last month, the SBC held a meeting of members where they passed a few new policy issues. They elected a new president, Bart Barber, approved creating a database of abuse claims and abusers, and signed off on creating a group to study changes within the church. What do you think about what came out of that meeting?
Well, I thought it was a good step forward. The prevention policies they laid out, there are some good ones. You've got to have two adults whenever anyone's with children. That's a good rule in sports and everywhere else. They have to have open doors when children are present. Another great rule, no one-on-one transportation. You can't let the adult take the kid alone in a car. Screening, those are good. But a lot of this didn't include the larger systemically needed changes. So there's no talk about having a code of conduct that every employee and volunteer must review and sign regularly. There's no protection for whistleblowers. And that's something that's critically important. People should be able to come forward about their concerns about a child being sexually abused without being shut out or isolated because they've come forward. And, you know, there's some specific proposals that I don't see there. For example, teenage volunteers should not be supervising young children without adult supervision. So there's a fair amount that they're stepping forward, but they have quite a far way to go to have a really high level child protective system. And what I would say to the parents in the SBC right now is it's an environment that is not yet going to curb the acts of sexual abuse by those intending to have sex with children. They're just not there. They're not going to be there overnight. And so parents, you know, I'm sorry, I'm having to say this repeatedly all over the country, you have to be hypervigilant now because the instinct to protect the institution, that's really hard to change in the rank and file. You may have some on the top saying that, but I've seen various quotes and statements out in the press at the lower levels, and it's going to take a long time to educate the entire entire set of believers that you have to take this seriously. You have to go to the authorities if you have a report, and you have to put the healing of the child first and foremost. Hard to do when the institution's been doing the opposite so long.
We're talking with Marcy Hamilton, founder of Child USA, talking about abuse within the Southern Baptist Convention. We're also taking your calls at 800-642-1234. Let's go to the calls now. We have Dave in Stevens Point. Hi, Dave.
Hi.
What did you want to bring up?
Well, I think she just hit it, and that was the main thing. And it's not just churches. The Boy Scouts. It's any other large organization, maybe not even large organizations, but it's the instinct of leaders of all of these institutions to protect the institution instead of the people that they're supposed to be serving. And until we can get past that with the leadership in churches and any other institution, we're going to continue to have this problem. So that's pretty much what I have to say.
Dave, thanks for the call. Marcy, what do you think?
Absolutely. And what's heartening is when the general public steps up and sees that and knows it and says it. So that's a great comment and really important.
And we do see, as Dave mentioned, not just religious organizations, athletic organizations, the Boy Scouts, any sort of big group can be subject to this kind of problem. And I'm wondering if you, Marcy, have seen organizations that have reformed for the better, where things are really working.
Well, there's a lot left to do in the United States. And so we actually studied all of the 32 United States archdioceses because they were the most sued. So you would expect they would have made the most changes. And what we found out as a matter of scientific fact is that the policies are all over the place and none of them are complete. So children are at risk in the Catholic Church, despite knowing about this cover-up since 2002. That's 20 years. So no, there is no perfect institution yet. We're really wrestling with changing the system, which means changing people's minds, that you really do put everything down when a child indicates they've been sexually abused, and you immediately go to the authorities and you immediately hold people to account. And, you know, for the rank and file, for the believer in the pews, it's intimidating to tell your pastor. And if a pastor says, that guy's one of our most valued members of our whole congregation, you get the message. This is about the organization and you better shut up. And the child then doesn't get that sense of, wow, the institution's here for me, and also doesn't get the sense of justice. It's amazing what happens if you take a child who has been sexually abused to the authorities and show them that what was done to them was a crime, was wrong, and it wasn't their fault. That can be healing, and so far the SBC has a terrible record on that. We'll see how far down they go in both implementing that and enforcing it. In fact, my biggest question here is not just that they set out some new policies, but how are they going to enforce them?
We just have about a minute left, Marcy, but I wanted to ask, in addition to abusers themselves, is it possible to have consequences for those at the top who might have known and ignored a problem?
Absolutely. There's criminal behavior by those at the top of every organization in the country, frankly, that has had these massive cover-ups. So whether we're talking about the Olympic system or we're talking about universities or schools or the churches, there's liability and there should have been criminal charges against those in power. But the problem is prosecutors are political beings, and it's pretty intimidating and difficult to charge the bishop that everybody loves, the pastor that everybody adores, and expect to get reelected. So that's why our view at Child USA is we must educate everyone. The public needs to understand this, so they'll just absolutely demand that kind of accountability.
We'll leave it there. Marcy, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you.
That was Marcy Hamilton, founder and CEO of Child USA, a nonprofit think tank devoted to preventing child abuse and neglect. We've been talking about a recent reporting that revealed a pattern of sexual abuse and cover-up within the Southern Baptist Convention and how the group is responding. If you or someone you know has been sexually assaulted, the National Hotline for Sexual Assault is 800-656-HOPE. That's 800-656-HOPE. The Wisconsin Department of Justice is also actively investigating clergy abuse. Their number, 877-222-2620. We also have their online reporting form linked at wpr.org/centraltime. Stay with us. More to come here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Dean Kinetter, in for Rob Ferret. Coming up, there's conflict, and then there's high conflict. An author shares how understanding the psychology of conflict can help us talk across our divides. Now, Wisconsin's primaries for governor and U.S. Senate are heating up with less than a month to go before primary election day. In the Republican race for governor, businessman Tim Michaels recently won the endorsement of former governor Tommy Thompson. Former President Donald Trump also endorsed Michaels last month. Polls now show him tied with former Lieutenant Governor Rebecca Clayfish. And the Democratic primary for U.S. Senate has two frontrunners, Lieutenant Governor Mandela Barnes and Milwaukee Bucks executive Alex Lazary. But recent polling shows that nearly a third of Democrats are still undecided. We're talking about election news right now, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you decided who you're going to vote for in next month's primaries, either the Republican primary for governor or the Democratic race for U.S. Senate? Or are you one of the undecided voters? If so, what issues are you looking to hear about? What's important to you in this year's elections? And do you have questions about how we can vote after a Supreme Court ruling banning ballot drop boxes? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@wpr.org. Barry Burden is a professor of political science at UW-Madison and director of the Elections Research Center. Barry, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks. Glad to be back.
Well, I want to start off with talking about the Wisconsin Elections Commission and this ballot drop box guidance. After the Supreme Court ruling last week, we just heard new comments today from Commission Administrator Megan Wolf about drop boxes and mailboxes. What's happening? Can you get us caught up?
This feels like a constant process in Wisconsin of court decisions and changes in rules. The latest is the Wisconsin Supreme Court ruling from Friday, which says that drop boxes, at least the unmanned drop boxes that a voter might use to deposit their absentee ballot, are not legal in the state, and that a person may not deliver a ballot for someone else unless they're appointed as an agent, maybe because the person has a disability or is hospitalized. The court did not reach a decision on whether a person could put another voters' ballot in the mail for them. But that is where Administrator Wolf weighed in today, recommending that voters don't do that, but also suggesting that they talk to their local clerks if they have questions. My guess is that clerks across the state will be implementing the decision from the Supreme Court somewhat differently, depending on where they are. There remain, unfortunately, some gray areas in exactly how this all works.
And the Wisconsin Elections Commission is still technically deadlocked after trying to take some votes on new guidance to local clerks. Barry, do we have a sense of how widespread and how heavily used those drop boxes were in the last election?
Well, we know there were hundreds of them in 2020. I think the Elections Commission had reported something between 500 and 600 drop boxes in use in nearly every county across the state. Certainly in big cities, they got attention, but they're also used in lots of rural communities, small towns and villages, where clerks often don't have offices or don't have staff, and so the drop box was helpful to them. Those are now all going to be padlocked or removed and not used. We don't know, unfortunately, exactly how many ballots came through those drop boxes. It's not something that is systematically recorded, though I think anecdotal evidence was that it was not trivial. There were a number of voters who found them really convenient, and election officials were actually encouraging voters to use them if they were concerned that the mail might not get the ballot back in time.
And Barry, I know you did a study of election clerks after the 2020 election. How do they feel about drop boxes?
Yeah, I conducted a survey last year and asked clerks, about 700 of them who answered the survey, what policy they thought was best for drop boxes. There were several options ranging from, I don't think they should be permitted at all, which is now the new determination of the Supreme Court, to I think they should actually be mandated. Every jurisdiction should have one. Only about 22% of clerks, so a little less than one in four, thought that drop boxes ought to be banned, ought to be prohibited. So that's a minority view among election officials. It's now the policy. Among the other three quarters of clerks, opinion was pretty divided. Some of them would allow it, but not mandate it. Some would mandate it. Some would put a maximum of just one box per municipality. So there were a variety of views on exactly how many ought to be deployed, what the upper limits ought to be. But most clerks were actually in favor of letting it happen.
And just before we get into the governor's race, Barry, I want to ask, this Supreme Court ruling from Friday that declared drop boxes illegal in future elections, did that say anything about ballots cast in drop boxes in previous elections? Did it make any, you know, statements about those being fraudulent or problematic in any way?
No, it's only a forward-looking decision. It says no drop boxes from here on out, and that includes the August 9th primary that's coming up and in the general election in November. The drop box issue, along with a lot of other issues related to absentee ballots, was litigated after the 2020 presidential election. There were something like six or seven suits filed in state and federal court in Wisconsin, as you may remember, and none of those determined that the absentee ballots from drop boxes or collection in parks or just about any other means ought to be set aside. So this is really just a prohibition going forward.
We're talking with Barry Burden, professor of political science at UW-Madison and director of the Elections Research Center, talking about election guidance news, and we're now getting into the governor's race. Let's talk about that race, which has shifted quite a bit here in recent weeks. The Republican primary for governor has two front runners right now. Barry, what are you seeing in terms of the GOP race for governor?
Well, I agree with you that it's two candidates at the top. That's Tim Michaels, who recently entered the race, comes from the business community running his own construction company. And Rebecca Clayfish, who has been in the race for many months, is a familiar face because she was lieutenant governor for 8 years under Scott Walker. Clayfish and had been the leader, I think, by all accounts. She had the most endorsements. She was the establishment candidate. She was leading fundraising over the other lesser-known Republicans. But Michaels has really shaken up the race. The latest Marquette poll from a few weeks ago shows them essentially tied in the primary, though many Republican voters remain undecided. Each of them was sitting at about 26% of the likely vote. So this one feels as though it's up for grabs. The opening bit mentioned that Michaels has gotten endorsements from Donald Trump and Tommy Thompson, two important leaders in the party, two very different kinds of leaders in the party. But Clayfish has the support of former Governor Scott Walker, Assembly Speaker Robin Voss, and many other legislative leaders. So the party is really divided between these two candidates at the moment.
One issue that has come up on the campaign trail is the investigation, ongoing investigation of the 2020 election here in Wisconsin, and the idea of decertifying the 2020 election, pulling back Wisconsin's electors. Republican candidate Tim Michaels was recently asked about an effort to do that. Here's his response to WKOW-TV.
You know, I have to work with the legislature and see what these bills look like. As a businessman, I just don't say that I'll do this or I'll do that. It's always about the details.
And as most election law experts have said, there's not really any pathway to decertify an election. Barry, what do you make of this issue continuing to come up in Michael's comments?
Yeah, there really is no pathway. It's a settled issue. And I think Rebecca Clayfish has said as much when she was asked the question. She wanted to look forward, not back, on these kinds of issues. You know, I think both of the leading candidates, really all Republicans running for office today, feel pretty intense pressure to show that they have deep concerns about the 2020 election, that they are doubtful that the election was proper. Donald Trump has weighed in, I think, a couple of times since Friday's Supreme Court decision, putting pressure on Robin Voss and others to do something, to change the laws, to do more investigations. So I think the Republican candidates will continue to be asked about this, both by journalists and by their supporters. And their positions, frankly, have been evolving. I think both Michaels and Clayfish have become more openly skeptical, maybe more aggressive in wanting to take on what happened in 2020 as the campaign has rolled on.
And how much of keeping that idea at least alive has to do with the favor of former President Trump?
Well, it's important. I think all of the Republican candidates, certainly these two who are in the lead, made a trip to Mar-a-Lago to visit Trump. They wanted his endorsement. When Tommy Thompson was thinking about getting into the race, he also traveled to Florida. Tim Ramphan, who's one of the lesser known candidates, an all-out supporter of decertifying the election, also made the trip and was hoping to get Trump support. So it's a huge element. It's not something that the candidates feel like they can ignore. And, you know, I think suspicions about the election or beliefs in the big lie are really animating a core element within the party. And so, you know, they're hearing it at Republican events around the state, and I think feel obligated to address it.
Are you seeing other differentiating issues, policy issues right now between Clayfish and Michaels?
It's hard to find much separation between them. They've certainly been asked about abortion and contraception since the Dobbs decision came from the U.S. Supreme Court overturning Roe v. Wade. I think they've ended up in very similar positions, wanting to enforce the law from 1849 that essentially makes abortion illegal in Wisconsin, but not wanting to go so far as to ban contraception. There may be a sort of gray area about morning after pills or other kinds of things. But really on that issue and lots of other hot button issues, there aren't many differences. There, you know, on election matters, I think there's some small differences between them about whether they would disband the Wisconsin Elections Commission or replace the commissioners or reallocate the authority there. That too is a set of evolving positions. But both the Republicans running for governor and the Democrats who are running for Senate are really quite similar to one another.
Disbanding the Wisconsin Elections Commission is something that a lot of Republican candidates have talked about. You mentioned a few of the ideas for what could come next if that happens. What are your thoughts, your concerns about the potential for a post-elections commission landscape?
Well, I'm not a fan of the design of the Elections Commission. It was created only 7 years ago and modeled after the Federal Elections Commission, which governs campaign finance in Washington. That too is a commission of three Republicans, three Democrats, and it mostly deadlocks. It's a really ineffective agency, unable to enforce campaign finance law because the three members of each party can't agree on much. And we've seen that play out in the Elections Commission. It replaced what I think was a much better model, which was the Government Accountability Board. It was in place for a small number of years until 2005. It was made up of former judges with no partisan attachments, and I thought worked quite well. But Republicans in the legislature and Governor Walker were distrustful of the GAB. disbanded it, replaced it with the Wisconsin Elections Commission. Now we're hearing Republicans say they don't trust the commission in various ways, and they want to potentially replace the commissioners or the commission itself. So it's not clear what kind of setup would be satisfactory to Republicans who are unhappy with the 2020 election result. I think it's really worrisome that politicians are meddling in what ought to be either a nonpartisan or a bipartisan effort to administer elections in the state.
We're talking with Barry Burden, professor of political science at UW-Madison and director of the Elections Research Center, catching up on the primary race for governor. In just a bit, we'll get into the primary race for U.S. Senate on the Democratic side. We want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What's bringing you out to the polls in next month's primary election? Maybe inflation, abortion access, another issue? What are you looking out for right now? Do you feel like candidates are talking about the issues you care enough about? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. We'll continue the conversation, hear from you, coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Dean Knetter, in for Rob Ferret. We're taking a look at the races for governor and U.S. Senate in Wisconsin with about a month until primary election day. Barry Burden with UW-Madison's Election Research Center stays with us. Barry, what do we know about the potential matchups in the general election, how Governor Evers would do against the candidates running for the GOP primary?
Well, we do have limited polling data about this. The Marquette poll has really been the only survey firm out there asking these kinds of questions. The Marquette poll from June showed a really close race in any matchup between Evers and one of the Republicans. Most of their breakdowns show Evers slightly ahead by a point or two or three. I think it's fair to say that those are all probably toss-up races. That's not going to surprise any listeners who have followed recent Wisconsin elections, the last two presidential elections, the governor's race 4 years ago that Evers won. All of those were essentially 1 point or in some cases less. I think we're in that territory for the governor's race again.
And important to recognize that there are still a lot of undecided voters out there, still a lot of time toward the general election, right?
Oh, there's a lot of learning going on right now. Voters are really just tuning in. Voting is underway in the primary. Absentee ballots are out, and we're going to see more attention, more advertising, candidate debates and forums and other things happening over the next few weeks. But mostly these primary candidates are unknown to much of the electorate and won't become known until the fall, until we get into September and October. People get back into thinking about campaign season. I think there's a lot of time for these races to firm up.
I want to turn now to the Democratic primary for the U.S. Senate seat that would take on U.S. Senator Ron Johnson. I also want to go to the phones right now. We have Art in Milwaukee with us. Hi, Art.
Hi. So I'm a supporter of Mandela Barnes. One, I think he best represents the people of Wisconsin as opposed to millionaires. But the Marquette poll also shows that he's leading among independents. And even though the Lazary ads imply that Lazary would be the strongest to beat Ron Johnson, the Marquette poll shows Lazary is the only one of the major candidates on the Democratic side behind Ron Johnson. So I think I encourage people to take a good look at Mandela Barnes and give him support.
Art, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Art talking about current Lieutenant Governor Mandela Barnes and Milwaukee Bucks Executive Alex Lazary. Barry, what are you looking out for in the Democratic primary there?
Well, this is a fluid race, I think maybe more fluid than the Republican side. Alex Lazary was really unknown to the public 6 months ago, but has become known because of his own spending. He's really invested in advertising and gotten himself close to parity with Mandela Barnes, at least in the polls. Sarah Godlewski has some traction as well. I think Tom Nelson is probably fourth on that list, not faring quite as well, but still in the mix. Again, there's gonna be a lot of learning about these candidates over the next couple of weeks, and we may see some movement. There are still some endorsements out there that may be snagged by some of them, maybe some gaffes by some of the candidates that will get them in trouble or some other kind of viral moments. So I think this one is still really up for grabs.
And as Art mentioned, he's concerned with who can beat Senator Ron Johnson. And that is something I think that the candidates are focusing on, too, in their election messaging. What kind of position are they carving out? What kind of things are they saying about the senator that tells us how their general election campaign might go?
Yeah, I think the vulnerability of Ron Johnson is really driving this race. There are 8 Democrats on the ballot, 4 or 5 who are in the top group. That's a long list of candidates to run against an incumbent in a year that is likely to be very good for his party. This is going to be probably a strong showing for Republicans this fall. The fact that so many Democrats have hopped into the race indicates that they think Johnson is beatable. And Johnson, I think, has largely done that to himself. He's a controversial figure, made some statements that I think are out of the mainstream about public health and climate change and the election and Joe Biden and Joe Biden's family and other things. His ratings in the Marquette poll are now more negative than they've ever been. Now, he's pulled off 2 previous elections as an underdog. I'm not sure I would call him an underdog in this race. I think it's pretty even, or maybe he's a slight favorite. But the Democrats at least think he is beatable. And that's a pitch all of them are making, that they are the ones who could take him down in the general election.
And the latest Marquette polling, I believe, was done before the Supreme Court's decision to overturn Roe v. Wade. And in the wake of that, President Biden and other Democrats have said, hey, use this as a reason to vote in November. Barry, is that something that you're going to be looking at as a potential energizer for Democrats?
Yeah, I think that's a really important moving piece in all of this. It's hard to say what it will look like in November. But at the moment, I think Democrats are animated by the abortion issue. They're obviously concerned and unhappy with what the Supreme Court has done. They would like to build their majority in the U.S. Senate and overturn the filibuster, or at least for the purposes of changing abortion policy. Joe Biden has said he's open to that, and Ron Johnson is in their way to making that happen. So I think Democrats hope and believe that abortion will be one of the things that fuels their success this fall.
Time for one more caller. We have Louis with us in Oconto. Hi, Louis.
Yes, I'm really excited about the U.S. Senate race and with our 4 candidates that are kind of leading the charge there. I really wish there was more coverage on that race going into the primary. And I really like the first candidate that announced, Tom Nelson. He's been probably the most visible out there meeting the people, and I hope people find that out about him. He really cares and listens to the people, so that's a good plus for him, I think.
Gotcha. Louis, thanks for the call. Barry, how much do you think can change in that Democratic Senate primary between now and August 9th?
Well, as the caller mentioned, this has been sort of a sleepy race. Even though it's a very important U.S. Senate seat, it's a competitive primary, it hasn't gotten the same attention as on the Republican side. I think that's because the Democrats have been nicer to one another. It hasn't been the kind of hostility that you've seen between Michaels and Clayfish and Nicholson when he was in the race on the Republican side. They may get a little tougher with one another as we get into the final days. It'll be all or nothing as they get close to August 9th. And so I would expect media coverage to pick up and voters to be energized as well.
And in our last minute, Barry, what are you watching for, keeping an eye on as we get closer to primary day?
Well, I think one thing to keep our eye on in thinking about the general election is what is the relative turnout in the Democratic primary for Senate versus the Republican primary for governor? Do we see more R's or more D's showing up in August? That'll be a sign as to the relative enthusiasm and energy in the two parties going into November. It's not a perfect indicator, but I think it's one sign as to whether the Republicans are going to be able to take advantage of the national environment that's working in their favor, or Democrats might have some surprising success in Wisconsin.
I'm sure we'll talk again. Barry, thank you for joining us.
Glad to be with you again. Thanks.
That was Barry Burden, professor of political science at UW-Madison, getting us caught up on the latest election news. Coming up tomorrow on the morning show, monkeypox has gotten a lot of news coverage lately with 2 confirmed cases in Wisconsin. We'll find out about the latest research and risk factors. That's tomorrow morning at 7 o'clock on The Morning Show. An exciting discovery in the art world today. The National Galleries of Scotland was getting the 1885 Vincent van Gogh painting Head of a Peasant Woman ready for a showing. They x-rayed it and found another painting. You see, Van Gogh must have been talented and frugal. To save money on canvases, he simply flipped this painting around and did a self-portrait on the back. But sometime in the early 1900s, the back of this painting was covered in cardboard and glue. The gallery will now see if it can be safely brought back to light. For now, the x-ray, complete with Van Gogh's intense gaze, will be on display. So, if you have any paintings laying around, take a peek behind them. You might have gotten a two-for-one deal and didn't even know it. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.